right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really looking forward to today's show because I'm going to be talking with two people that I've wanted to get together with for a conversation for quite a while. But before we get into that, last week I made an announcement that the video of the groundbreaking talk by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, was now online at revolutiontalk.net. So now, at the back end of the show, I'm going to be sharing a sample. It's called How Long? How Many More Times Did the Tears Have to Flow? But right now we're going to be talking about war with my two special guests, Jerry Lemke, author and professor, and David Zeiger, director and producer. And I'm going to be introducing them in a minute. We'll be talking about the people who go to war and the people who wage the war, whose interest it's in all of this. And we're going to talk about the people who stand up against it and refuse to do this, the people who courageously refuse to carry out this intensely immoral, inhuman wrong. We have to dig into this because we are faced with a situation now where war again is not a myth. It's not a, you know, it's a real possibility. You look at this bloated fascist killer that we have running things right now, and you listen to what he's saying, and you better pay attention. And so I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Jerry Lemke, who's an associate professor emeritus at College of the Holy Cross. He is the author of Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal, and many other books, including one he did on PTSD, which I really enjoyed. And I had a long interview and discussion with him just a little while ago around that. And we are also, I'm also pleased to welcome back to the show. And I had to rope him and pull him over and get. Actually, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show is Dave Zeiger. He's a director and producer, best known for the documentary Sir No Sir, but he's also got a ton. You know, Dave, I was looking the other day, I was just looking at your list of the films that you've done, and it's pretty remarkable. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a while.
You've been doing it for a while, and it's also, you know, you also have, there's a through line in a lot of your films. Mm-hmm. Not everything is about, you know, about one subject, but there is a lot that actually digs into and brings out, I think, from the first one I ever saw of yours, which had to do with immigrants in the Southwest.
In Georgia.
Yeah. And it was very, you know, I remember looking at that, and at the time, I was just blown away by it. But then I watched it again recently and just thought, there's something really, really, there's a through line there in terms of looking, you look at where people are situated in the world, and then what happens to them.
Yeah, and it's all connected to my own experience, my own life, and looking for humanity wherever.
Yeah, and yeah. I want to tell people that Sir No Sir, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. And it's because the situation in the world is so intense, including the November 4th, which is coming up really, really fast, all right? And it's the opening day of a whole campaign to drive out the entire Trump-Pence regime, all right? And it's people going into the streets and staying in the streets. First, whoever's going to come out on November 4th, staying out there, and then growing to millions and millions of people all across the country that can actually get rid of this Nazi regime. And sisters and brothers, if we don't do that, if it is not done, this question of stopping this whole regime, then I think humanity is in a terrible situation. And so we can talk about that with Dave a little bit later on that too, because he is also one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. And I think he's got his fingerprints on this. See, you shouldn't have been playing with your fingers.
No fingerprint.
All right. So let's jump into things right now. All right. I think what I'll do is I'll start with, I'm going to have both of you speak to this, but I guess what I'll do is I'll talk to Jerry first, and then I'll bring you on.
Okay.
All right. And it's basically this. You ready for this, Jerry?
I am.
Okay, man. Good to hear you again.
The temptation here is that David and I might end up speaking at the same time.
You know, it would be like a WrestleMania.
Talking over each other, yeah.
Right. And I'll determine who wins, okay?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Well, you know, one thing is that we have this series, and you and I had begun to talk about this a little bit last week, but the Ken sure. Burns and Lynn Novick series, The Vietnam War, let's start by talking about your assessment of the significance and impact of this film.
Well, gosh, let me begin by saying that David and I are really paired very well together. I think David's film tells what actually happened in the way of GI resistance to the war and veteran involvement in the anti-war movement after they returned from Vietnam, or I should say after we returned, because I was in Vietnam also in 1969. And then my work really is what happened to the memory. of those things, right? Why do so many Americans today not remember that GIs resisted the war, and so many people have forgotten about Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the organization? And so I think David and I are really, we're kind of a 1-2 punch. David telling us what we need to remember, me having some explanation, I hope, for why it is and how it is that we have forgotten these things. And one thing you said, Michael, is that in passing, you said, well, everybody now knows that spitting on Vietnam veterans, you know, never happened, and it's not true. And I wanted to interrupt and say, not true, Michael. Because if we, the Burns and Novick film, really, I think the through line of that film is all about anti-war movement hostility to Vietnam veterans when they return. The real punch on that one comes toward the end when a former activist said, and she apologizes for having called Vietnam veterans baby killers. And that's something, you know, that some people want to say, well, everybody knows that didn't happen. And I'm talking to people now who don't know that that didn't happen and who are finding that voice to be very credible. And then that branches off into larger conversations that Burns and Novick, I think, their storyline supports that, well, you know, Vietnam veterans weren't treated well when they came home. And, well, there was some hostility to Vietnam veterans. And, well, I remember this or that happening to Vietnam veterans. And, unfortunately, I think that's what the Burns and Novick film, that's what they are trying to get us to, quote-unquote, remember, right, which is really these legends about the war, and all of which, again, I say, displace, push out of memory the very story that David Zeiger tells in his film, Sir, No, Sir, which is the story of veteran resistance, GI in-service resistance to the war.
Mm-hmm. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Jerry. The important thing about these two things, about my film, Sir, No, Sir, and Jerry's book, The Spinning Image, is not just kind of getting history right. It is the connection between that history and today. And I think the Burns and Novick film, there's a similar thing there. Here you have a very powerful series, which I'd certainly recommend people watch, that purports to tell the whole story from many different points of view, from all the different points of view. We can get into a lot of things about that. But one thing that is striking in the series, again, which has been true all along since the 1980s, is that the reality of the soldiers themselves organizing against the war, resisting the war, taking all of, like you have in that series, a lot of exposure of the brutality, the genocidal nature of the war. Nothing about the fact, with a few exceptions, that the soldiers themselves who experienced that, often they were the ones who opposed it. They were the ones who organized demonstrations. I was involved in a demonstration in Killeen, Texas at Fort Hood of 2,000 active duty soldiers outside the base demanding that the war end. There were over 500 underground newspapers published by soldiers themselves. You have to purposely not want that story to be part of the story of the Vietnam War in order to not have it in there, because it was so prominent and so massive a part of the war. And what's when it's been eliminated from memory and it's been replaced with the mythology of soldiers being spat on, soldiers being called baby killers, all of these things, the result of that has been, and it was the case with the first Gulf War in the 1990, and it's been the case with Afghanistan and Iraq, that the ability of people to oppose those wars, to expose what they are, is undercut in a huge way, to the point where you accuse the United States military of committing genocide in Iraq, of targeting civilians, you immediately are accused of calling the soldiers baby killers, and you are immediately shot down. And what's most right. disturbing is so many people who know better, who were part of that movement and who could be very much part of a movement, a very powerful movement against these wars, believe the lie. They believe that, well, right. this must have happened because so many people say it happened. And it's a huge chilling effect on people today. I was talking to Michael yesterday about this, you know, the obsession with thanking soldiers for their service You know, and part of that is ignoring the fact that soldiers are human beings just like everyone else. They not only they have a responsibility, like all of us, to know what's right and wrong and to do what's right and not do what's wrong. And in fact, by international law, it's a crime to follow an order to commit a war crime. And so it's necessary for soldiers to be as much part and veterans to be as much part of the debate about these wars as anyone. And what's been attacked in this whole mythology is even the idea that you tell a veteran that the war that he fought in was a criminal war, that you even confront people with this. Go ahead.
David, you know, so many questions are being asked, in part because of the Burns and Novick film. You know, what are the lessons from the war in Vietnam? And they, even the filmmakers, use that expression, we need to learn the lessons. The lesson that you won't get from their film, and I think that we do get from your film, is that that war did not stop itself. That the war stopped because it was stopped. And it was stopped by the victory of the Vietnamese people over the war machine, but also with the support of an anti-war movement here, stateside, and a critical element in that were the veterans and the GIs themselves. In some sense, I mean, where your film really ends is that the war in Vietnam stopped because of the people who were sent to fight the war at some point refused to fight the war. People refused to go out on patrols. People refused to do their intelligence gathering missions like the Air Force guys that are in your film. And I think that's somehow, you know, that has kind of gotten washed out of this history, too. So the lesson there for the current wars today is that we really need to be about, you know, taking away the capacity of this U.S. war machine to wage war. We really need to speak to those people who would be sent off to fight these wars, and we need to reignite that culture of resistance and refusal to fight these wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. Did you want to say something?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. The question that comes up in my mind, here we have Trump openly threatening to completely destroy North Korea. And he made a statement today saying this is the calm before the storm. What do we do then? What do we tell the soldiers? What do we say? Do we thank them for their service, or do we do everything possible to encourage those inside the military as well as all of us outside the military to prevent that from happening? Because it's a crime, and it's a crime that has to be stopped. And and this is, you know, go ahead.
Thank you for your service, by the way, is a kind of dog whistle, inviting this false memory that soldiers were not treated well when they came home from Vietnam to begin with, or that they're, you know, if it's present day, that they're not being treated well if they're coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a kind of, that term dog whistle, you know, it's a kind of indirect way of inviting people to remember, folks, remember how guys were spat on when they came home from Vietnam, or called baby killer from Vietnam. Then that saying, that thank you for your service, it's so pernicious in that way. You know, it's such a kind of hidden stealth rhetoric. And like you suggest, you know, we have to find ways of calling that out, like you've just done. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that anti-war people certainly should be about. We should not be about reproducing that or legitimating that kind of rhetoric.
Let me remind listeners that you tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker David Zeiger and author Jerry Lemke about, well, we're talking about soldiers, Vietnam, what happened then, question of responsibility on many levels, and what it means for today. And it's a very interesting conversation, because I was thinking of when I was coming over here and when I was sitting at home trying to think, okay, how are we going to get into this? There are so many ways to carve into this and so much that needs to be talked about. No, I mean, it's serious, really, Jerry. It's like, you know, because it's like...
It's hard to get out of it.
Yeah, yeah, you guys, in the large part, Jerry, you've written a lot about this, and so you've put a lot of your life into it. And I know David has put a lot into it as well in terms of the films he's made. But, you know, one of the things that you guys were both talking about in terms of what What does it mean to say we appreciate your service, or we thank you for your service, or we do this, or we recognize that, you know, you've been treated badly over the you know, when you were fighting and when you didn't have any support, and you know, when you came back, and now all through this, that people don't really understand what happened. And there's a certain thing that goes along with what both of you are talking about, even in terms of as it sort of leaks over into what have they got up for today, as you were pointing to, David. And the thing is, you had this thing where praising the soldiers for giving their all in a very bad situation. And they were alone. They were heroic. The Roman centurions that were sort of like, you know, just marching, and the arrows were hitting them. But they stayed as much as they could. They stayed on the track. And that's, you know, whether that now that there's also the big question of whether or not that was true, mm-hmm. because it's there has mm-hmm. a lot has been hidden. Yeah. And then there's the thing about what they're even beyond whether or not that was true. There's what they're putting out to people today, including people who are joining the military today.
Right. Yeah. This is a very real phenomenon. And I just to take this back for one second to both to my film and to Jerry's book, I would argue very strongly, and people really need to understand this. You do need to go back and understand what really happened in order to understand what needs to happen today. And Jerry's book in particular, he lays out such a very clear case of what really happened, how soldiers did not consider themselves to be ill-treated by the anti-war movement, to say the least, or to their fellow young people. They weren't spat on, all of these kind of things. It's extremely important to know that in order to kind of break out of the spell that Jerry's talking about, this kind of spell of you know, the dog whistle, you know, is blown and you have to immediately fall into line. And it's also important to understand how this was used as a way to undermine opposition to America's wars. This is absolutely a burning, very crucial thing to take on today. I mean, you know, what's heroism in war? I think if you see my film, Sir No Sir, you see incredible heroes. And they are heroes because they, recognizing that the war they were fighting was a criminal war, was an imperialist war, they opposed it. They fought it. They went to prison. Their lives were destroyed in many ways. And they took a stand that is being ridiculed today as something that no one ever should do.
Right. To your first point there, David, these spitting stories came into existence almost literally at the time of the first Persian Gulf War.
Right.
At the time, the anti-war movement was just finding its voice to oppose what was coming in the fall of 1990. That is when all of these stories of Vietnam veterans having been spat on began to come out. And that was my research. I said, where did these stories come from? How long have they been around? And the answer to that is that almost literally they had not been around before then. And it's like some people refer to it as an urban legend, and that's not bad, right? They just kind of began to proliferate, and they were coming from conservative, right-wing, pro-war circles. But then they were quickly picked up, unfortunately, by some Vietnam veterans. Some Vietnam veterans began to say, oh, yeah, that happened to me, right? But your point is that then that stifled the anti-war voice. I had students at Holy Cross College at the time who early on came out against the war, and then when they began to hear these stories about spat on Vietnam veterans, they were coming to me and saying, did this really happen? Right? Who, you know, and they want to know, who were these people who did the spitting? And, well, it was pretty easy for them, right, to kind of put things together. Gosh, the same people who were hostile to the Vietnam veterans are these same people now who are speaking out against the bombing. Gee, maybe I shouldn't be against the bombing. And we know where that went. That went into the Yellow Ribbon campaign. That went into support the troops, you know, but not the war, a kind of twisted rhetoric. And that carried over to 2003 and the invasion of Iraq. And so my point is, you're absolutely right, David. That is one of the legacies of these legends and these false stories. It's very, a very important political legacy.
Just to add real quickly, you know, again, from Jerry's research and his book, at the time, during the Vietnam War and in the immediate years after, there were absolutely no claims of anyone being spat on. There were no claims of people being called baby killers.
Right.
These things did not exist at the time. It was just the opposite. And this is extremely important because I've had situations where people have, you know, in the course of, you know, my film and et cetera, you know, I was spat on or my dad was. Every time I've challenged that, the story changes. And it's because I might as well have been spat on, you know.
Right.
I mean, because, you know, and one of the things, there's this kind of bullying. It's a total bullying that goes on, you know. If someone says they were spat on or someone says veterans were spat on, if you question that, it's outrageous. Yeah, if it falls apart. Yeah. But you're considered to be outrageous to question that happens.
Right. And David, it's the same thing now with the baby killer story.
Yeah,
the Burns and Novick film really kind of headlined that just a couple of days ago. And I encourage listeners, do this yourself. Go use the New York Times archive and, punch in your keywords to see if there's any report of these stories around. And the answer is no. The very first one I have found, a New York Times story, was 1979. And then it's a kind of, I don't know, third person kind of report that you could dismiss as hearsay of a Vietnam veteran having been called a baby killer. 1979, right? This is, 10 years or 8 years after there's supposed to have been thousands of Vietnam veterans come home and they were denigrated as baby killers.
Yeah, you know, one thing I wanted to ask both of you guys, because there is a point to, like, for instance, there's a thing that comes up a lot in people I've spoken with, and it's My Lai. You know, and it was the one thing that everybody knew about, you know, in a certain sense, that you saw it, and it became one person was responsible for it, and that's who paid, you know, who was supposedly going to pay the price. But it also, it was sort of like, it was the shame, but also it was sort of like, you know, there was something more behind it in a certain sense. And I thought that was really interesting to look at this in relation to, you know, what they've been doing, what was shown in their film, and, you know, how you folks have spoken to this. But also there's a question here too, because, and this is going to combine two kind of questions, but, you know, it was interesting because my assistant producer was pointing out the other day that Henry Kissinger, who actually speaks and introduces the film and all the stuff, that he actually was the person who was cast to set the moral standard for this film. Henry Kissinger, okay? You know, think about that. How many times can I say Henry Kissinger without puking and understanding and knowing what he set loose in the world and who he worked with and what he was doing and what it meant? And he's standing there and he's actually saying that it's all about healing. So you have on the one hand, you have this thing about My Lai and how they dealt with that. But then it's about healing, because My Lai was a product of the desensitization of the GIs. It was a product of just people going wild with bloodlust and suffering so much. And it's sort of Kissinger's calling for a healing of all this, he doesn't admit about war crimes, but he says, let's just heal. And the main thing in healing is, let's not question what GIs did or were forced to do in Vietnam.
Right. Well, I don't know. There's a couple of things there. I mean, one is the mythology that the United States, you know, was a very unified, kind of happy political and cultural onesie before the war. And it was the war then that divided the United States, and the anti-war movement particularly that divided the United States. And so we have to heal, right? We have to go back to something that, in my mind, I say we never were to begin with. And so the war gets used in that way, too. The other thing about My Lai is that it's really one of kind of the odd things of the war, is that My Lai is one of the few things that a lot of Americans do seem to remember about the war. The politics of the war, the reason the war was fought, you know, are lost. The economic interests that the U.S. Had there in Southeast Asia are lost. And people have kind of glommed on to this atrocity thing. And here's what I think on that, and Michael, I may have said this on your show before, is that one of the twists, I think, one of the odd, curious, ironic, paradoxical twists in memories about the war in Vietnam is that the way this comes out then is it's a way of thinking of how the war itself victimized Americans and how the war itself turned American GIs, you know, these young well-thinking young men were turned in to these monsters, right? To carry out something like the massacres at My Lai. It's a way in which we've come to think about My Lai as one more piece of evidence that we were victimized by this war. The war turned us into these monsters, right? Rather than, I mean, a lot of people have written this that, and actually we see confirmation, I would say, of this, unfortunately, in some of the wars that we're fighting today, is that American men in particular, are very capable of doing some of these awful things, and we need to think about that, right? We need to think about the kind of masculinity in this culture that is being produced that makes us vulnerable to the appeal of going to war in general, and then, you know, vulnerable to the opportunities to do these very awful things. But that, again, that's something that we don't really talk about when we talk about My Lai. We don't really get into sort of the cultural depths of what might possibly explain why something like that happened. One credit to Burns and Novick in their treatment of that is that we do see, they do tell us about Ron Rodnauer, who was the young soldier, a low-ranking soldier, who blew the whistle on that, and then Thompson, the helicopter pilot, who sat down between the people who were doing the shooting and the Vietnamese. So we do also get those pieces in the Burns and Novick film, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, I was actually surprised to see in the Burns and Novick film that they mentioned the fact that the Department of Defense suppressed evidence of many, many atrocities like My Lai, which is something that's come out in recent years. And I forgot the author at LA Times and another journalist book, The War They Carry, something like that, which is the recently declassified Department of Defense documents that show that, you know, dozens, even hundreds of massacres along those lines. And I think, yeah.
You might be thinking of Nick Turse's book.
Well, no, there's Nick Turse's book. There's one other, too. But but the thing is, and what you're saying is very important. There were those people who tried to stop it, and there were those people who exposed it. And one of the films is the Winter Soldier film, which was 1972 film of the one of the most powerful things Vietnam Veterans Against the War did, which was a war crimes tribunal in which veterans themselves testified to the crimes that they witnessed, that they were part of, that they were ordered to commit, all of these things. And it was the soldiers, again, the veterans themselves exposing this and taking a stand with humanity rather than this kind of, well, I had no choice. I'm going to, you know, I'm pissed off that no one's, you know, telling me what a great job I did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In wars in which this country invades and occupies and attempts to control another country, which was what the Vietnam War was, then the responsibility of the soldiers and veterans becomes a very big question, whether you're going to carry out search and destroy, whether you're going to kill everything that moves, these kind of things. And the blame, yes, ultimately the blame is on the part of the government. These were policies. These were things that soldiers were ordered to do. That's true. On the other hand, in Vietnam, for the first time in history, soldiers themselves in the United States military stood up against that, you know, fought against it, you know, very powerfully. Fraggings, there were recorded 1,400 instances of soldiers killing their own officers. And they didn't do it just because they weren't allowed to smoke dope, because they were allowed to smoke dope. just 500 underground newspapers. This was a massive thing that soldiers did. So you cannot really talk about the role of soldiers and the role of veterans and the response of the of American people to veterans without understanding that aspect of what happened.
All right. Now, let me tell you this real quick, guys. There is on November 4th, it's going to be the beginning, and it's being called by Refuse Fascism and refusefascism.org. And actually, David, you are eventually I'll ask you to say something about this, but you are one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. And this point around what needs to be done, you need to understand the kinds of things that we're talking about right now. People who are not in the military, people who are in the military, people who might choose the military because that's the only way they can get a life, you know, a living. So you're looking at this and you're thinking, okay, we have to actually look at what's really happening in society. We are up against a major historical turning point. We are up against something that could, if it doesn't go well, if it continues on the trajectory it's on, it's going to change the history of humanity in the world in ways that you can't even imagine right now. At the same time, if we are able to come together and do this and to stop to just, you know, drive out the entire Trump-Pence regime, if this movement is able to drive that regime out, then yes, it can also be different in ways that we don't imagine today, all right? And it can really lead into something very, very big. So, and I also want to make a point to both you guys, because we're going to go into this now. Recently, as we were talking, Bill Taxman, he called to make a comment. I think it's very important, a very important comment. He talks about the Vietnam series being sponsored by, not by the Society for a Better World, not by, you know, a higher education and good thinking, but it's among the people it's sponsored by includes David Koch and Bank of America. You know, and I think both of them had kind of a nice role in Vietnam, right? As well as, you know, stripping and raping the rest of the world. So, you know, Bill, thank you for that comment. I think it's really well taken. So which one of you guys wants to start first in terms of all this, what you've been talking about, and what it means for today?
Well, what I want to start with, you know, a whole lot of the opposition to the war in Vietnam is a credit to alternative radio that, by my recollection, sort of sprung up during those years. Something called back porch radio or pirate radio in places, I was aware of it in places like Madison, Wisconsin, and Portland, Oregon. But this was going on all over the country. And in David's film, you know, there's this just wonderful piece about pirate radio in Vietnam and the way that GIs formed their own radio station in Vietnam to get around, the official radio that was coming out of Saigon. So these things that you're talking about and that we need people to support are very, very much a part of building a movement. The communication that goes on, you know, the trading of experiences, the trading of advice, the dissemination of analyses that we have about the current situation. I think that is just so crucial. And we've lost a lot of it already, and I really don't even want to think about, you know, losing more of what we have. Gosh, we just absolutely need to have support for programs like yours.
All right, Jerry, I want to thank you very much. And we're going to have to cut this short, though, because I'm going to have Dave say something, and then we'll go ahead, David.
Well, I just can't say anything more. Just real quick, I went to see Margaret Cho last night, and it was packed. And, of course, she tore into Trump, and people went wild. They went crazy. And I was thinking, watching this, the sentiment is out there so strongly, but the action isn't. And that sentiment has to be turned into action because things are in danger. The world's in danger, and that's what November 4th is all about. And I just wanted to kind of put in a pitch for that because we have to turn our anger and our sentiment into action. Very important.
Very well put. All right, Jerry.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. Talk to you again soon, man. Bye now. All right, that was Jerry Lemke, Associate Professor Emeritus at College of the Holy Cross and author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal, PTSD, and many more. Jerry's last name is spelled L-E-M-B-C-K-E. if you want to look for some of his books. And David Zeiger, director and producer of Sir No Sir, he also created the PBS documentary series Senior Year, as well as Displaced in the New South and The Band. He is the founder of Displaced Films. You can find his films at displacedfilms.com. In addition, there's a website for Sir No Sir, sirnosir.com, with lots of videos on Vietnam and the resistance to the war by veterans, GIs, and many others. In fact, right now I'm going to play a clip from Sir No Sir talking about the Winter Soldier war crimes investigations, which Dave and Jerry were talking about earlier.
In a cramped Detroit hotel, a new organization, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, held an unprecedented investigation that exposed a much deeper truth.
I think the Winter Soldier investigation was to try to point out, it wasn't really in defense of Cali, but it was going after the notion that the policies of the U.S. military created things like My Lai, okay? That it was a policy. It was both a written and an unwritten policy. And the truth has to be told. You can't duck away from the truth. You can't lie and put up a smokescreen and say, oh, this is the words they used back then, an isolated instance of aberrant behavior.
You weren't just coming home saying I'm against the war. You're saying this is what we did. This is how we did it. This was a crime. This was wrong. Helped people to really cross the bridge and to see us in a way that I think the anti-war movement had not seen GIs before.
America went through a choke, okay, because they didn't want to believe that these things occurred in the name of the American people, supposedly supporting freedom and liberation and democracy throughout the world. And there was this terrible slaughter, this terrible, inane slaughter. So I think the question was, why are they going after Cali, where Cali was doing precisely what we were all told to do when we were in Vietnam, essentially, okay, which is kill them all and sort it out later.
In Quang Tri City, I had a friend who was an advisor with an Arvin group, and one time he asked me would I like to accompany him into a village that I was familiar with to see how they act. So I went with them, and they didn't find any enemy, but they found a woman with bandages. So she was questioned by six Arvins, and the way they questioned her was, since she had bandages, they shot her. She was hit about 20 times. So after she was questioned, of course dead, this guy come over, who was, and knowing him, he was a former major. He was in the service for 20 years, and he got hungry again and came back over working with USAID, AIDS International Development. And he went over there and ripped her clothes off and took a knife and cut from her vagina all the way up, well, just about up to her breast, and pulled her organs out, completely out of her cavity, and threw them out. And then he stopped and knelt over and commenced to peel every bit of skin off her body and left her there as a sign for something or other.
And so I gave other testimony, one about the rabbit lesson, which I thought was very important, and I still think it is. And that was at the end of staging battalion at the Camp Pendleton base in California for Marines before you went to Vietnam.
Where the staff NCO comes out and he has a rabbit, and he's talking to you about escape and evasion and survival in the jungle, and he has this rabbit, and then in a couple of seconds, everyone just about falls in love with it. Not falls in love with it, but they're humane there. He cracks it in the neck, skins it, disembowels it, just like I testified that this happened to a woman. He does this to a rabbit, and then they throw the guts out in the audience.
And takes the skin of the rabbit and turns it inside out and makes a little booty for his foot and says, you might have to do this in case your helicopter crashes in Vietnam or you're separated from your unit. And I thought the subtext of that little lesson was to completely brutalize people.
You can get anything out of that you want, but that's your last lesson you catch in the United States before you leave for Vietnam.
And I went and listened to the 3 days of testimony and absolutely came away from it emotionally drained and floored by it. I never grasped, even up to that point, how powerful was the genocidal plans and strategy of the U.S. towards the Vietnamese people. On every level, you know, whether it was Agent Orange and Dow Chemical reconfiguring the napalm, because the napalm wasn't sticking to the Vietnamese skin enough. I mean, that was, you know, all of this just added to the overwhelming sense of the criminality of the United States.
That was a clip from Sarah No Sarah on the Winter Soldier investigations. We're going to take a musical break and be right back with some words from Bob Avakian, so stay tuned.
Same song we sang, coming over and over again. Picking up now, getting more like a game. And it feels real like we'll end up fake the fame. And there's never more than one truth, but you can't.
That was War Again by Balkan Beatbox. Now, we're going to hear Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, in an excerpt from the video BA Speaks Revolution Nothing Less. This excerpt is, How long? How many more times do the tears have to flow? So let's give a listen.
If I were a preacher looking out at what goes on with the nightmare of oppression and brutality that so many in this world are forced to endure day after day, generation after generation, I would cry out, How long, O Lord? Now, in case there's any confusion, I am not a preacher. And I'll have more to say about the Lord as we go along. But let's look at what this system does to people. Let's start with just one great crime of this system. Police murder after murder after murder of black people and Latinos, especially youth. Check it out. If you go on the internet and you search for police kill unarmed youth, you will scroll down and down and down and down for pages and pages and pages with the same pattern, the same ugly pattern repeating itself. And you will see that not only are these youth unarmed, but once again, overwhelmingly, they are black and Latino. And if you search a little deeper and a little further, you will see that almost never are the police punished or even prosecuted for these grotesque and wanton murders. And you will run into two of the most wounding words in the English language at this point: justifiable homicide, which the family and loved ones of those so wantonly killed are repeatedly slapped in the face with as the verdict on these murders. Let's just take a couple of the latest outrages. Manuel Diaz, murdered by the police in Anaheim, shot in the back and then shot in the back of the head. While the next day in the same city of Anaheim, another Latino youth, Joel Acevedo, was also shot down by the police. And here's an irony that came out in relation to the murder of Manuel Diaz. His mother said at one point Manuel was thinking about joining the army. Think about this. You can be a black or Latino youth out on the streets with no prospects and no future, only the possibility of getting yourself into trouble, running up against other youth just like you and maybe getting into it with them, or running up against the police. Or you can join the army of the same system that's put you on the street in that situation to reinforce with brute force the same system that has put you in that situation, and to go out into the world and be part of the mindless killing machine doing the same thing to people just like you all around the world. Or what about Oscar Grant, killed a couple of years ago in Northern California by the BART, the Rapid Transit Police? This was also caught on the cell phones of many people. They knocked him to the ground, straddled him while he was face down, and shot him to death. Captured on the cell phones, but it made no difference. Through the lengthy process they always go through, in this case because the people rose up, they had to prosecute. But once again, we run into the situation where, strangely, in these kind of situations, the prosecutors who vigorously prosecute with full animus when they're going after someone like Oscar Grant forget how to prosecute when it's the cops on trial. And the whole thing is set up so the cop gets off on a light charge, a minor sentence, and is back out. Think of the outrage of this and the insult on top of the outrage to the family and loved ones and to everyone who cares about justice. Or what about Romarley Graham in New York City? Killed in his own house by the police. He's walking home in his neighborhood. He's a black youth, so the police assume he must be up to no good. He must be selling drugs. He looks furtive. He's making strange motions. What he's doing is taking out his keys and opening the door to his house. He walks into his own house. He's killed in his own house by the police in front of family and loved ones. And in response to this, his mother comes forward and says, "This has got to stop." And his father, almost as if in a trance, keeps repeating over and over again, "Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son?" And they weren't done yet. The New York cops then came to the courtroom and applauded their fellow pig who murdered Romarley in cold blood, viciously taunting the family and loved ones of Romarley and demonstrating yet one more time the ugly truth that in the way this country has been built, and for the powers that be in this country, the humanity of black people has never counted for anything. They have never been valued as human beings, but only as things to be exploited, oppressed, and repressed. How many more times does this have to happen? How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? And if this is not enough, this system viciously exploits people twice, abusing and brutalizing them, and then taking the tortured beauty of their cries of agony and outrage and capitalizing on it, declaring it to be a great expression of the marvelous American culture and its diversity. Think about the blues, for example. There's a lot of stuff in blues that's about personal problems and some nonsense, including men wanting to dominate women. But to a large degree, the blues is about the experience and the suffering of black people in America. Notice it's called the blues, not "La, la, 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 we're living the American dream." Or how about jazz? I'm thinking of when I moved to Chicago in the 1970s. I didn't have a car, and I had to take a cab. And I got in a cab that was driven by this hip young white guy. I don't mean these kind of phony hipsters they got around now. I mean a real hip young white guy. As we started talking, it turned out that he was a jazz musician, or a musician in general, and was just driving a cab to try to be able to keep going. He reminded me of a scene I saw in a Richard Pryor concert, where he got up and, before he came on the stage, Patti LaBelle and her band had performed. And Richard Pryor said, "Did you see that white guy playing the saxophone up there? He was just like this, with every note, he didn't miss a note, just like, 'Go ahead, brothers, I'm with you. I ain't missing it. Go ahead, I'm with you.'" And that's what this cab driver reminded me of. And after we talked a while, he said to me, "Are you into jazz?" And I said, "Well, not really that much. I've listened to some jazz, I like it, but I'm more sort of into rhythm and blues." He said, "You really got to get into jazz. If you listen seriously to jazz, if you listen to Coltrane, what you hear is all the long years of oppression and suffering of black people coming right out the end of his instrument." So I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have to get into jazz some more. But there was a deep truth there. Yes, there's love, as Coltrane put it, a love supreme. But there was also defiance and anger. Now, how many times does this have to keep going on? Now, once again, I'm not a preacher. And if people crying out, "How long, O Lord, could put things right?" there should be no more need for people to keep on crying out in this way, and no more need for them to keep on praying. The Lord should have put things right a long time ago. And if the Lord really existed, we would have to ask, what is the matter with the boy that he let things go so wrong for so long in the first place? Now, the truth is, there is no Lord, and we do not need, nor should we want or accept, any lords and masters, imaginary ones or real ones, lording it over us. Some say this is all God's will. No, it is not. And it does great injury to those suffering so terribly and so unnecessarily in this world to tell them that this is God's will, or attest that this supposed God has set before them to endure horrible oppression in this world with the promise of a better life in some other world, some afterlife, which is not real and will never come. But ask yourself this: if there were a God or gods, why would it be the will of that God or gods that for so long, so many people have suffered so terribly with oppression, degradation, and brutality, while a much smaller number continue to accumulate wealth and exercise power and live lives of parasitic indulgence on the basis of exploiting and oppressing those masses of people all over the world? Why would that be the will of this God? And then let's go on and ask the next question that suggests itself. Whose interest does it serve for people to believe that all this is God's will? Now, I know there are people who feel inspired and sustained by their religious beliefs in the fight against injustice, including the unjust wars repeatedly waged by the American government. Some have spent their lives dedicated to acting on what they identify as prophetic traditions within religion, which they see as calling for standing with and standing up for the poor and oppressed, and fighting against injustice. We respect and work to build unity with people holding and acting on those sentiments. In accordance with the communist principles and objectives on which our party is based, we recognize the great importance of reaching out and building unity broadly with people of many diverse viewpoints in the fight against the crimes of this system and the great suffering this causes. And these same principles and objectives also lead us to recognize the importance of boldly and forthrightly putting forward our communist viewpoint and of engaging in serious and principled discussion, and yes, struggle, with people coming from different worldviews, in the spirit of seeking the truth and striving to bring forward and to act in the fullest way in accordance with the fundamental interests of the masses of people. It is in this spirit that I am putting forward the views of our party, straight up and full out. Communists are atheists. We do not believe in any gods or any kind of supernatural forces or beings. There is no evidence for the existence of a god or gods, or of any supernatural forces or beings, no evidence which is based in the real world and can be tested in this real world, which is the only existence there is. There is, however, plenty of evidence for the fact that human beings have invented gods and supernatural forces. Now let me say this. I am sick to death of the daily and continual horrors that life under this system means for the great majority of humanity. And I am sick to death of having to say how long, even if not, O Lord. And while I am a firm scientific atheist and do not believe in any gods, I can say, and I do say, God damn these motherfuckers.
All right, that was How Long, How Many More Times Did the Tears Have to Flow by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And he's speaking in an excerpt from the video BA Speaks Revolution Nothing Less. As I said, the entire talk, which is about 6 hours long, is available at revolutiontalk.net. There's a link to it on revcom.us, and I would really encourage listeners to check out the full talk. This talk is dealing with one of the most important things there could be, the real possibility of bringing into being a radically different world, where all this madness, all the oppression and injustice, all the abuse and degradation that is so much a part of life now would be gone, done away with. It's an incredible introduction to BA himself, the most radical revolutionary alive, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the author of The Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. So that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my guests today, Jerry Lemke and Dave Zeiger. I also want to thank everyone who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going out now with Revolution by Dr. John. Talk to you again next week.